Hello, you're listening to Series 2 of Brownie Podcast, where we celebrate the cultural confusion of being born in Britain with roots in Asia. Brownie Podcast is co-hosted by me, Shivani Kocher, and the lovely Ashani Bhatt. We hope you really enjoy the episode. Hello, Brownie listeners. We're back after a long hiatus and are so excited to welcome Rahul Raina as our guest on Brownie Podcast. Rahul is a Kashmiri novelist and author of the brilliant debut book, How to Kidnap the Rich. The book is thrilling and fast-paced, and it's a razor-sharp tale of kidnap, corruption, and class dynamics set in Delhi. We've had the pleasure to get our hands on a copy, which we couldn't put down, and we recommend you all to go out and get one. So hi, Rahul. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, guys. Nice to talk to you. Nice to meet you. And I'm so glad that the podcast is back.
Oh, thank you.
We're too, especially in this new makeshift recording studio that we've got set up. So hopefully the sound quality is good and there are no technical difficulties. It's 2021.
Let's kick off with your incredible book, How to Kidnap the Rich. Could you just summarize it for our listeners, please?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's set in modern India, it's set in modern Delhi. It's about, you know, a kid who's born into poverty, into really difficult circumstances, and how he decides to, you know, make a life for himself, make money for himself by, you know, faking exams for really rich, lazy, stupid, upper middle class people in India, and how he does incredibly well in the, you know, the top national exam, and how him and his client, the guy who he's faked the exams for, get into a huge amount of trouble because, you know, life at the top in India can be just as dangerous as life at the bottom. You know, there's more to go for. There's more, you know, money at stake. So that's what it's about.
And so what inspired you to write about this topic? So the idea of being able to pay for access to areas of privilege, it's a really interesting dynamic. And is that something that you've observed, or was there something specific that inspired the topic?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Obviously, you know, I was born in India, but then I moved here, and a lot of my friends in India obviously have had to go through the Indian exam system, which is crazy and which kind of rules your life for about 15 years of your life. And they have all had lots of crazy stories about how, you know, they've seen rich people buy their way into privilege and buy their way into the top places and into scholarships and stuff like that. And as well as, you know, being part of the British education system, I think you'll all agree that there are certain cases in which certain universities have certain interesting admissions policies, which may end up with a rather undiverse pool of students. And yeah, it's that sort of thing. It's friends in Britain, it's friends in India, it's friends in America. And I just thought, let's tie all these things together and turn it into a story about how all these things are connected in today's globalized world.
Yeah. And so it's really interesting that you say you've taken inspiration from Britain and India, but you've chosen to set the book in Delhi. And there's a great quote from the book, which I'll just read. It says, "Delhi isn't saffron, Delhi isn't spice, Delhi is sweat." So how come you chose to set the book in Delhi?
Well, I think part of life being, you know, kind of a writer or a novelist writing about Britain and London and places like that today is the sense that London doesn't really seem like a city anymore. It kind of just seems like a kind of a playground for like international capital. So it kind of just seems a bit grey. It seems a bit lifeless. It seems as if everything has been sandblasted away. I mean, I spent my first early years in this country in London, and it was a totally different place. You know, it was a lot more diverse. It was a lot more poor, at least the parts that I was living in. And it seemed as if it was a lot more equal. So part of the trouble about writing about Britain is the sense that the city, if you're writing about London, isn't really a character, and it loses the sense of place. Whereas that is never a problem with Delhi, right? The city itself, you cannot go through that city and think that you're anywhere else. You're always in Delhi. So that's what I wanted, that sense of the city being a character, of it being a character in terms of sound and light and in terms of effort and in terms of just a physicality on the page that Delhi brings that, you know, Britain, I feel, kind of doesn't.
And how much time had you spent in Delhi prior to writing the book?
A couple of months every year. So yeah, enough time to get used to. And obviously the fact is that, you know, if you're going as an immigrant to Delhi and you just spend a week in a hotel or you spend a week with your family, you don't have to deal with like the boring, crushing crap reality of life, you know, paying bills, getting new phones, dealing with corruption, trying to sell a house, trying to just these boring quotidian problems, which I've just gotten used to with India. It's just life in a daily sense, it's just so much more difficult there. And that's kind of what I wanted to bring into it. The sense that this sort of divide between being a second generation sort of tourist and being a sort of a first generation person who has to deal with that reality day and day and day after day.
Yeah. And you capture this sense of India that's kind of creaking towards this sense of modernity, but still has these elements of corruption that you just mentioned. And I think while there's an implicit criticism of whiteness, and kind of the West, middle classes in India are still ultimately striving for these jobs that are in the UK or the US. And so what do you think it underpins that dynamic? Do you think it's a post-colonial hangover? Do you think there is just talk to that dynamic between the position of India in the book and the West.
I mean, it is a really interesting one, isn't it? Obviously, you know, as immigrants in this country, we talk about whiteness quite a lot and how, you know, systems of whiteness are perpetuated and about how we feel being part of those class and racial dynamics. But in India, people don't really talk about that, but they still obviously strive towards ideas of whiteness all the time. You know, they want to send their kids for masters in foreign universities. They want to whatever. They want their kids to work for white companies. They want their kids to be able to speak, you know, a kind of English in a way that white people speak it. You know, they're not happy with their kids speaking English. So that's that divide in Indian society. Nobody really wants to talk about racial dynamics, and yet they want to perpetuate these racial dynamics all the time. And, you know, for me, the other part of it is that, you know, if you're an Indian middle class person, kind of like an upper middle class person 20, 30 years ago, you were rich, you were doing well, but you were only doing well in an Indian context. But now, if you're a rich upper middle class 1-5%, you're doing well in a global context, mm-hmm. like you're making a six-figure income, and you can aspire to those kind of facts of whiteness and a life of whiteness in a way that you couldn't, because if you were earning whatever, like a 1% income 30 years ago, you couldn't end up working in California and being a multi-billionaire. It was very, very difficult. Yeah, a couple of guys made it, but now you can easily do that. You can easily go from an Indian sixth form college to a white university to Silicon Valley and be a billionaire in about 5 years.
And do you think wealth is that vessel or that route, or do you think it's just that the world is a lot more open, it's a lot more connected, there is a sense of the world being more so on our doorstep? What do you think has changed that dynamic?
It's definitely that dynamic. It's definitely the fact that the internet has come around. It's the fact that, you know, India as a country is going through like about 5 or 6 revolutions all at once. You know, it's going through a gender revolution. It's going through an industrialization revolution. It's going through a computer revolution, a revolution in terms of LGBT stuff. So it's a country that, you know, it's changing so massively, and yet it's still stuck to some of these things in the past. And I think we can never talk about India without talking about the caste system, you know, like we can never talk about India without talking about the caste system. And these things, you know, we talk about money and the access to money, but the access to money is only ever there if you're high caste or if you've been able to play the caste system in India in a way that your low casteness can be used to aspire to money. You know, like you guys all know about the reservation system in India, right? About how, you know, you can, if you have money and access to power and you've managed to build it up, you can cheat the system. And so you can be officially a lower caste person, but you've been living, you know, a high caste life for the last 60 or 70 years because your access to politics has been, you know, allowed you to play the game in that way.
And I think it's interesting that you've chosen Ramesh, who he's the protagonist in the book, and he doesn't come from a middle class family. And yet his relationship with the West and whiteness is one of almost superiority, almost, you know, he looks down on the West in a very different way from the middle class families and characters in the book who are aspiring to be as Western as possible. And I was just wondering if you could talk a bit about that, because it's a really interesting choice from you about his characterization.
So like when we were sending this book out on submission to publishers, there was a sense from some editors that they didn't understand what was going on in terms of that dynamic, because this isn't, you know, a post-colonial book. You know, we've had whatever, we've had 60 or 70 years of post-colonial literature, which is, you know, a term I absolutely hate. I hate that word. I mean, I hate that phrase. And they were confused because this book in many ways is a post-Western book, which I feel is a really interesting dynamic and one that's really going to start coming into fruition in the next 10 or 20 years. There's a sense where these rising big economies in the East, you know, China, India, whatever, you know, the Philippines, Indonesia, they see themselves as the inheritors of this post-Western world. And they push back against these Western values of kind of anti-racism and anti-casteism. So that's part of the dynamic that I wanted to talk about. The fact that there is this whole different world and different set of civilizations rising in the East that see themselves as superior and better and different because the West has sort of totally destroyed itself in the last 10 or 15 years. And that kind of post-2008 dynamic, you know, we are all, I think I am, you are, we are kind of inheritors of this post-2008 world where the West sort of seemed to stop working for a while. And who knows whether it's going to recover or not. Mm. Whereas in the East, you know, in India, in China, they don't see that at all. You know, they see themselves as having won the race and the future is theirs.
Mm. And just kind of speaking to that as well, have you published your book in India? And is there, are you going to, if not, and has there been a difference in reception or how you expect it to be received in the East and the West?
Yeah, so when my relatives in India first read this book, a couple of them said, yeah, I mean, you're just going to get lynched. So that'll be nice to go back to when I do go back there eventually post-corona. Obviously, there's a sense, if you're a writer in India, of being a more of a target. You know, there's an actual sense where writing in India and in that part of the world seems to matter more. You know, writers are held up to be kind of these truth tellers in society. Whereas kind of in this country, you know, TikTok and YouTube, those are the people that matter in some senses. I'm sorry to say that, you know, like we're all writers. We all love that kind of thing. But, you know, the word has a primacy in India and in developing countries that it just doesn't do in the West anymore, kind of where a more post-novelistic, post-journalistic, post-literal society in the West. So yeah, it's been published in India, a couple of the reviews are coming out, a bunch of people have read it, and yeah, I enjoy getting kind of viciously murdered in a couple of years. That would be nice.
All right, so sign of success when your critics are shouting quite loud, I think.
Hopefully. I mean, yeah, that kind of thing doesn't happen in South London, does it? Or maybe it does, I don't know.
Find out.
Maybe it happens, I don't know, Sally Rooney or something.
And what I was quite interested in was how the idea of kind of middle classes putting pressure on their children to succeed and to do well and to pass their exams certainly speaks to a stereotype, which, you know, I think is of this wider South Asian parent figure of, you know, always achieving the best and really running through. And I think while it's a stereotype from my experience, it's also to some extent a truth. So I was wondering what your take on that dynamic was and whether within the kind of Western world, whether you see that being something that still rings true, particularly I think to this kind of British Asian community, this British Indian community, where that really lies from, where that comes from.
You know, that is the problem about writing immigrant narratives right now and has been for the last 20 or 30 years. The fact that there are these stereotypes, but they are true stereotypes, aren't they? You know, growing up in this country, I mean, I'm a first generation immigrant, so I'm not really a second generation immigrant. So I had to learn English. I had to do all of that stuff. It was quite, you know, challenging and it was quite difficult. But there is that pressure. You know, if you're an Asian person in this country, there is a pressure from your parents that I don't think middle-class white people really face that pressure, that kind of overwhelming sense of you've got to get into this university, your grades have to be perfect, you have to get into this place, you have to do that. And the fact that kind of when you're like 10 years old, it's as if they're kind of mapping out your life for you. Like my white friends in this country didn't really have that. Even the ones who were kind of in private schools, who were in whatever, like 35 £1,000 private schools, they didn't have that sense that their parents were kind of pushing them towards, you know, professional paths. You know, they could be like woodworkers if they wanted. You know, like I know people who've gone to like 50 grand a year private schools who are like making violins. And if I did that, I would get murdered. And so it's a stereotype, but it's also, there is a sense of truth to it, because you come to the West to make money. You know, like my parents like were quite un-PC when I was a kid, and they were like, we've come to the West to make money. You've got to make money. You know, there are non-white, there are brown people in this country who haven't made money. And that's the worst thing that you can do. So, and again, that's about an aspiration to whiteness. They think of the West as a place where if you work hard, you will make money. But in India, you can't do that because there are all these things closing you off and stopping your life from progressing. All these big forces and corruption and whatever. So yeah, that's part of the trouble of being a non-white novelist in this world. How do we write about these systems that do exist, but without doing it in a way that kind of white people have made fun of in the last, whatever, 10, 20 years?
Yeah, I think with a couple of our other guests, we've talked about stereotypes and how, you know, ultimately you don't want to reduce what is quite a complex dynamic to a stereotype for the sense of a joke. So a stereotype in a jokey sense is obviously not what we would want, but I think showing the layers behind it, that it's not just, you know, very simplistic pressure to succeed, to better yourself. And that's not very idyllic. It's not, you know, rose tinted glasses, but there is a dark level behind it, which I think ultimately shows the truth that it's not idealized, I think is probably the take. And ultimately, I think it's a way in which we can show that there is complexity behind stereotypes. It's always one that you're never quite sure whether you should play into or completely ignore. But ultimately, there are truths out there for some sort of a reason, which is...
I mean, can I just ask you a personal question? Like, are your parents, like, what do your parents think about your career paths right now? Like, are they, like, happy? Or do you not care because you're, like, second gen and you just don't give a crap about what they think anymore? Like, has that changed for you guys? Because for me, my parents still check up on me. And they're like, why isn't your novel getting adapted for HBO right this very second? Why aren't you on TV right now? Why aren't you rich?
Right. Like, I mean, from my perspective, I think there's always a sense that the generation above you wants the next generation to do better. So I think the thing that I always feel is, even if I don't really verbalize it, I do feel that pressure. I always feel like I want to show that I'm doing well, and I want to show that all of the access and the privilege that my parents were able to grant me, I am kind of one-upping, not one-upping in terms of doing better than them, but I am taking advantage of that. And so I think for me, it was always a sense that it was going to be something ultimately quite corporate. It was going to be something that, you know, was quite, I suppose, conventionally successful in like a professional sense. But I'm not sure whether that was because ultimately that's what I wanted to do, or whether that was what I was told success looked like from a young age. And I think that's quite hard to unpick, but I certainly feel the pressure. And I feel like anything big that happens to me career-wise, I always want to really make them proud, which as a 26-year-old, it seems quite lame to say that still making my parents proud is my biggest motivation, but it is. And I think definitely there's the sense of them having made a lot of sacrifices that I want to make sure that I'm showing that I've made them worthwhile almost.
I think it's like a subtler pressure, because you were talking about, you know, your parents, Rahul, being quite clear, we've come here for a reason and we need to succeed. And I think, well, definitely for me, the sort of open conversation I have with my parents is, you know, your happiness is the most important thing, and we want you to do what you really love. But then there's also a kind of narrowness to that picture. It's kind of a bit subtle and less said, but sort of still we internalize that pressure, and there's still that sort of immigrant guilt, especially because our grandparents, you know, suffered really a lot and worked really hard. I think I talk about that with friends that you know, their grandparents are from China and they're not necessarily from India, but we still have that feeling that we have to succeed because so many people have given up so much for us to be here, and we don't have it hard at all in comparison.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, one of the most interesting things I found is that, you know, I am, I suppose, part of a generation of millennial novelists, but the ones who are white so much of their fiction is driven by the fact that they think that they won't be as successful as their parents' generation, that all of this access to money and stuff is just totally kind of evaporated. You know, all the Sally Rooneys and Megan Nolans and Nisha Dolans and Candice Carty-Williams of the world, you know, that is such a central tension behind their millennial current fiction, the fact that they think that their lives are retreating in some sense. And I just think that's so different from this immigrant context of us thinking, yes, our lives are going to be better than our parents. We're going to have more access to everything. Mm-hmm. Everything is going to work out. And for me, that's just really interesting as an immigrant novelist. You know, there aren't that many non-white novelists right now. And yeah, I just find that interesting as a tension. You know, our parents still firmly believe your lives are going to be better. But for so many, you know, white people and non-white people right now who are writing books, they don't think that's true at all. I just find that really interesting.
I wonder how many generations it would take for, you know, will our children start feeling like those white novelists, or will it be the next generation? Or I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's how we bring them up as well, and how much of the guilt we
I think it's also how like alive those stories are. I think I still... I'm lucky enough to have my grandparents, and I speak to my grandma about her struggles, and hearing it from her voice in her words, I think makes the struggle feel very real. And then I hear it from my parents directly. And I think that these stories are stories that are being told to me directly rather than being heard through hearsay or, you know, a historicalized version, I think makes it still feel very real. So maybe there is a point at which when I'm speaking to my children or my grandchildren about my grandma when she came over, that would change slightly, potentially.
That's true.
Once again, can I ask you something else? I know this is turning into the other way around, because I'm thinking about this kind of thing right now because of what I'm writing next. What are the books that have spoken to you guys in the last kind of 1 or 2 years, but why have they spoken to you? Like, about kind of being kind of, I don't know, a millennial or being kind of a working person in today's world?
Put us on the spot here. I think it's a big mixture, because in so many ways, you know, I can, when I read your book, I can hear, when I go to India to visit my cousins who are quite middle class in Bombay, and I can hear their voices in some of the characters of your book, but then I can also see myself in these sort of intellectual like university girls in Sally Rooney's novels, for example. And I think really you might disagree, but it's kind of hearing different bits of your own experience in different places, and I'm never going to fully identify with one of Sally Rooney's characters, because fundamentally I'm not white, and yet at the same time we've had quite a middle class experience, and in some ways quite a white experience, and so it definitely speaks to me. But then it's also when I read you know other books like yours that I can hear parts of, I can hear my family in there, I can hear my cousins in the language, in the swear words, like the way in which you capture India, like that really, really spoke to me as well.
Yeah, I think for me the books that really resonate are ones that are written with that kind of person of color experience, because it's ultimately still very rare to hear those books. So We're All Birds of Uganda, for example, was a book that I read recently, and just being able to see Gujarati written in the text, for me, my mind was blown, because it was so close to the world that I know and the language that I hear around me, that I think for me that still feels like quite a rare thing, and it takes me by surprise in a way that, because the trope of, like, you know, the millennial middle class kind of confused character, it is still quite, you know, there's tons out there about it, so I think because it's more rare, I'm always more captured by that. But I am, as Shiv would say, I think a synthesis of the two. I just think I probably want to seek out more of those stories, because there is a part of me that, you know, representation is great. It's really great to feel like you're identifying with a character. And I think ultimately for a lot of, you know, South Asian first, second generation immigrants in the UK, we still don't get very much of that. So I always kind of jump at the chance to see that.
I also find it interesting when I relate to an immigrant experience that's not specifically South Asian. So yeah. There was a fantastic book. I think it's called The Stubborn Archivist or Stubborn Archivist. And
by Yara. Yeah.
And that, you know, she's actually from a Brazilian, well, her mum's from a Brazilian background. And again, I have no sort of personal or familial affinity to Brazil, and I've never been there, but it was just that outsiderness. And I think she's a mixed race character because I think her dad is from the UK in the yeah. book. And I think often that speaks to me quite a lot when there's an element of whiteness and an element of mm. otherness. I think that sort of resonates with my personal experience mm-hmm. a lot as well. Mm.
Interesting. So I didn't mean to turn this podcast into mining you for information, because this is always what happens to me in my friendship group, because like my friendship group is like 70-80% POC, and these are the conversations that we just have all the time.
Yeah.
And it's like this kind of running joke that all I'm interested in is just asking questions and listening and going like this. And kind of
jotting down notes in your notes.
Exactly. And thinking, oh, this'll yeah. Let's see what advance I get for this one.
But my next question really relates to what we've been saying, and I loved the language you used in your book. You had Indianisms, you had swear words, you had Hindi words. I was just, and I know that English is English your third language? I know that you said that you had it's third. So just wondering about, you know, your language choices and why you decided to write with this kind of big mix of languages and words, and also whether you had any thoughts to if the way in which you've written the book would alienate people who didn't have a familiarity with the language used in India, or the Hinglish that they use in India.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this all turns into a big question about publishing, doesn't it? If I'd known more about publishing, and if I'd actually ever been inside a writing class, or if I'd done like an MFA or something, perhaps I would have made different choices. But I just wanted to write something that people like me, who kind of had a familiarity between English and India, would just enjoy and would just be able to pick up and think, you know, this is what India is like. That's the only thing I've ever really wanted somebody to say when they've read this book. This is what India is like. Mm. And in terms of the linguistic choices, yeah, absolutely. It should be like an overwhelming sense that you've just been slapped in the face. That's the only thing I ever wanted. It has to reflect the way that the country is. And I think we've all read these really awful South Asian novels, which are kind of set in India or wherever, Pakistan, Bangladesh, where they have a word, and then instead of italicizing it, because that's kind of going out of fashion, they spend about three sentences explaining what it is. So it's like, I had a chapati, which is a type of white flour bread that you make a breakfast snack out of. And it's like, who the hell talks like that? Like, yeah. Nobody does, right? Because you don't ever have to explain yourself. So that's what I was looking for in this book. Bam, 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 bam. No explanations. Now, would it have been easier if I had explained things? Would there have been more money? Would there have been... That's part of the whole conversation around publishing. And I don't actually care about that. Yeah. It's about reflecting things as they are and not as I want them to be. And frankly, I don't care about what some editor somewhere wants. And frankly, my editors have been lovely. So actually, yeah, let's point that out. One of them is South Asian, one of them is a white woman, and they've been fantastic about it. They've never asked me to explain anything. So that's actually quite cool.
Yeah. Well, you've really achieved that with your language, honestly. Like, for me, it felt wonderful to read a book written like that. So thank you, really.
Thank you. Yeah, wow. Somebody being thankful rather than saying, you swear too much, you don't explain things, why do you do this, why can't you... It doesn't matter.
And wait, that kind of brings me on to the next question. So who do you see as being the reader of this book? Who are you writing for? Do you think it's people from the UK that have that knowledge of India, so are able to dissect that language and understand it without that glossary? Do you think it's for people in India that are obviously very much more familiar?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the central tensions in my life as well. You know, who am I writing for? Who am I? Because in one sense, I'm just this kid from India who moved to this country because we didn't have a huge amount of money in India. That's part of my life. So that's the sort of people that it's for. People who are immigrants, who've gone across cultures, who've had to change the ways that they speak and think and talk and whatever. But in another sense, you know, I've graduated from a good university, a set of good universities. I've got a great job. I live in a kind of a multicultural city and in a world. And I have these friends from all these different cultures who have gone through the same sorts of things that I have. And that's also who it's for. You know, the amount of people I've had from like Brazil and Nigeria and Indonesia and Singapore who've come up to me and said, hey, this is just what life is like for us. Mm-hmm. And that's true as well. But then also in some sense, I am a British person who knows about kind of white British fiction and what people kind of expect and what people want. So there are all these different worlds that I'm part of. And I suppose in some sense, the book was just trying to link all those three things together, obviously while trying to downplay the British side massively, because that's not what the character would do. Like when I'm writing, I'm always thinking about what does the character do? What does the character do? What does the character do? I am not that person. A lot of people seem very confused that I'm not that person, but I just like inhabiting somebody else. That's what I enjoy doing. So that's kind of also what I had to do, a person in India who's seeing this massive change. You know, that's why the book is from his point of view rather than from somebody Rich's point of view, which would lose a huge amount of tension and would lose a huge amount of the color of the book. But it's about a person seeing their entry into this world of riches and wealth and all that kind of thing.
Did you ever think about writing it in Hindi, or was it always going to be?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because so my kind of writing journey is that for like the last 5 or 6 years before I wrote this, I just kind of wrote every night for myself. I'd never shown any of this work to anyone apart from when I started sending it out to British literary agents, right? Which is its own interesting tension, you know, like the people who pick and choose are white British people generally. There's like 3 literary agents in this country who are like black and like 1 who's South Asian or something crazy like that. I was thinking of writing it in Hindi, but then we all know about, you know, if you're an Indian person, you know that the books that have sold, the books that are big, are books that came from abroad. You know, they're white, they're POC writers who went abroad, published their books abroad, and then brought them back to India. That's been the story of our publishing culture, whether it's Salman Rushdie or Arundhati Roy or whoever. They came from abroad, even though they were one of us. And so, yeah, I knew I couldn't get away with writing in Hindi because, you know, advances in India being what they are, you'd get about 200 quid for it. That's what you get for a Hindi book. Like, and that's like a high figure. And that's, again, an interesting tension. If you're a non-white novelist, you have to balance these things out. You can't just be writing in your native language. I couldn't write in Hindi. If I wrote in Kashmiri, which actually is my native language, I'd get £5 probably as an advance, and somebody would print it out and send it out to Srinagar. So that's, again, another tension, yeah.
It's interesting because we went to see Arundhati Roy give a lecture, and the theme was translation. This was a few years ago. Yeah. And she sort of started her entire talk around the fact that at the first reading of God of Small Things, somebody, this was in India, had put up their hand and said, why haven't you written this book in Hindi? You're an Indian. You've betrayed our nation. And her response to that, well, it was a long talk, so there was a lot of response to that, but her immediate response to that was, actually, I've written this book in the way that I think, that I'm thinking and I'm writing in that language. So I was just wondering, is that the same for you? Do you like naturally think in the kind of language you've written in, or was that more of a conscious decision when you were putting words on the page?
I mean, I'm thinking in Hinglish, I'm kind of thinking in Hindi Urdu, I'm kind of thinking in both those things and translating in my head on the fly, I suppose. I told my publisher, can I be entered for the International Booker Prize for the ones that are in translation? You know, I translated this book in my head. They weren't happy about it. So that didn't happen. But that's the process that goes on in my head, because I speak like 3 kind of main languages, and I speak whatever French and German and stuff, but I'd never be able to write anything in that. So for me, this process of translation, of going from Hindi in my head to English on the page, is something that I've been doing since I was 5 years old. So it's part of my natural process. So yeah, I suppose I couldn't have written this language in Hindi because I'm not used to thinking in Hindi and then writing in Hindi. That's not a thing that I do. So it would be more natural for me, and I suppose for the character as well, to do this process on the page. So yeah, that for me is, it's a reflection of who I am, yeah.
So we've kind of chatted about the book. We just wanted to chat to you more about your sort of personal life and background, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
And we have touched on this Can you tell us about your background?
Okay, yeah. So this is the Kashmir question, which is, you know, if you're a person from Kashmir, everybody expects you to write about Kashmir because you've got this whole universe of things going on with kind of politics and corruption and violence and all that stuff. No, so I was born in Delhi. But my family lived in Srinagar, which is the main city of Kashmir, until the late 80s when they moved. Then I spent the first 5 years of my life in India. We didn't have a huge amount of money. We were kind of from one of those lower middle class families where you've got some sort of a university education, but the sense of progression isn't really there because of people barring your way and about corruption and about all these sorts of things. And so my parents just felt it was easier to move to Britain. And so they got a student scholarship, both of them, and they moved to Britain sort of on a Commonwealth scholarship. So I like the Commonwealth. British Empire, I'm not so sold on. Commonwealth, I think it's fine. Obviously, that's a bit selfish. And so, yeah, we came to Britain and we kind of didn't know whether we wanted to stay. So we kind of moved back and forth for the first 10 or so years that I was in this country. Then we decided to stick here. I got my British passport. I, in fact, told my parents at the time, I don't want a British passport. I want an Indian passport. I'm Indian. And they said, you'll get deported otherwise, which they were sadly proven right on in some cases. So yeah, I'm glad to them for that. So yeah, and then I've gone through the British school system and I've been very glad that I've gone through the British school system because all my friends who are in India, they've had terrible problems with the Indian school system in terms of mental health, in terms of expectations, what we were talking about, you know? So I think I've lived a kind of a normal immigrant life, I think. And then that, yeah, kind of led into writing. But yeah, I never wrote in creative writing classes and stuff because at university, all the people who were into creative writing were a bit weird, were a bit strange, and they only were interested in white British narratives, which I found very, very annoying. Mm-hmm. And if they were interested in immigrant narratives, it was all about how do you fit in to the white world, which I just found incredibly annoying because I've never wanted to do that. I've just wanted to be myself.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, we both studied English actually. And it's another thing that we've discussed on this podcast, but having studied English and read English literature for 3 years, I think I did one paper on writers who weren't white, essentially white men.
Yeah.
That was really sought out. It was, you know, something that I had to go and chase after. And the fact that it's just not taught, it's not accessible. These narratives aren't the thing that's feeding down. So ultimately there will always be a disjoint because your world is built up of the stuff that you read and that are familiar to you. And if that's not coming down through education, through, you know, school curriculums, then there will ultimately always be this disjoint and it will be the same white male voices that we're hearing time and time and again.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, think about the extent to which non-white literatures have been dominated by people who did English at Oxford or English at Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they had to go through their university experiences not reading anybody like that and thinking that they weren't part of that situation must have created such an interesting internal tension inside their heads. You know, I always feel how much interesting and amazing literature were we robbed of just by people making boring, dumb faculty decisions like in the 1970s or 1980s. But that's interesting. You know, English universities, my next book's going to be set kind of in an English university, but with POCs, but unapologetic POCs. They're just going to be blowing shit up for no reason. So I'm really excited about that. And yeah, that's the sort of thing I'm interested in. English universities are weird places. They're weird places. And the fact that we have recreated those systems in India for me is just so odd. It's so odd. But, you know, that's a whole other kettle of fish.
And so you moved to the UK when you were 5. So I imagine the experiences of kind of adjusting to life in the UK, you know, are accessible to you because you're at that sort of age where you're able to remember those stuff. So from your experience, what was that period of adjustment like? What was the kind of cultural shock or kind of element of adjusting? And how did you cope with that as a family and then also yourself individually?
So one of the main things that I learned in this country was that it doesn't really matter how well you speak English, but it matters the accent in which you speak it.
Yeah.
So until I was like 12, 13, 14 years old, my English wasn't really amazing. It was broken. It was a bit stilted. In fact, it kind of still is. I kind of mispronounce stuff all the time. But if you could fake an accent, and it could be a relatively middle class, upper middle class accent, people would forgive those problems because they would just think that you were just being a bit kind of individualistic and a bit kind of unique and kind of, you know, kind of interesting. So yeah, that for me was an interesting survival mechanism. I probably don't recommend people doing that because it's just crazy. Just learn the English language a bit better, I suppose. Or you know what? Don't. Just speak whatever the hell you want, you know? That's part of my interesting laissez-faire process that I've gone through in my life, rejecting this kind of sense of you're an immigrant, you have to do things one way or the other. And I just kind of feel, you know, what the hell? Just do what the hell you like. I don't really care. Yeah.
And you said you had a British passport now. I was just wondering, culturally, would you describe yourself as British or what would you say?
I mean, obviously, culturally, I describe myself as Kashmiri because that's the only language where if I'm speaking it or hearing it, I actually feel anything. When I'm speaking English, I feel as if I'm just trying to make money. When I speak Hindi or Urdu, I just feel, oh, Jesus Christ, you know, what's going on now? It's a bit chaotic. But yeah, Kashmiri is for me it's the only thing that I really feel connected towards. And obviously what we've gone through and the Kashmiri people have gone through in the last 20 or 30 years, when you're speaking to anyone, they have this expectation, you know, you mention Kashmir and the eyes kind of go like this, like, oh God, no, poor you, look what's happened to your people, etc. So yeah, I don't try to mention that in public a huge amount. But yeah, Kashmir is where my heart is. You know, I've been a couple of times. It's a wonderful place, a wonderful people who are just sick of being in one of the most militarized places on earth. And they're sick of having all these hundreds of nuclear bombs being built to fight over them. And we've kind of gotten forgotten. Our story's been forgotten. Yeah.
So, yeah, do you think you ever will write about that one day? Or is that something you want to stay away from?
Look, once again, British publishing and American publishing. If you write a book about Kashmir, it's got to have a cross-religious romance. It's got to have one of the characters where their brother is a terrorist and then the other character's brother is a police officer. And there's got to be some sort of showdown at the end where somebody blows up. Those are the sort of things that they're interested in. And I'm just not interested in doing that. I suppose it's oppositional because if somebody expects something, I just don't want to do that thing at all. I want to write about immigrant narratives in a way that feels interesting and fresh and which blows stuff up, which expands the range of what's inside our heads. Because, you know, none of us really think of ourselves as immigrants, do we? We think of ourselves as people, you know, who are surviving in a system and we're making our way in the world. So yeah, I'm just against immigrant novels and immigrant narratives. And I suppose I'm just trying to annoy white editors in some way. Just trying to give them something which is completely not what they want or what they expect and which will annoy my publicists, which, you know, all of my books I think currently to date have and I think probably will in the future.
Long may it continue.
Yeah, exactly. I like to annoy junior employees of publishing who are poorly paid. Yes, that's my wish. That's my dream.
We've touched upon this in strands throughout our conversation, but we want to move on to publishing and kind of South Asian Indian writers, but also your experiences of publishing and diversity representation, etc. So what do you think about kind of the levels of diversity in publishing? I think, as you touched upon, it is still quite rare to, first of all, see publishers who are not white, and also the levels of kind of novels that are being produced by people of color is still ultimately quite limited. Was it a difficult experience for you as a person of color trying to get How to Kidnap the Rich published, and what were your experiences through that whole process?
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel bad about how easy it was for me to get published, so which is really annoying, right? Because I wish I had more of a horrible sob story, but for me it took like 3 days to get an agent, and like a month later there was a publishing contract on the table, which was just incredible. But I know how rare that is. You know, out of 100% of novelists, I think 4 or 5% are non-white in this country. And out of that, you know, South Asians, I think in terms of Sunday Times bestsellers, 0.7% of bestsellers last year were by South Asian authors. And most of them were like Salman Rushdie and, you know, Jim Palari and people like that. Mm. So in the industry, there are very, very few of us. And I was very lucky to have a South Asian editor as well. And there are very few of them. I think out of the 300 editors in this country who can buy fiction and who can publish fiction, I think about 10 of them or 15 of them are South Asians. So I had three or four out of them bidding on my book, which was just incredible. And I didn't know how rare it was. You know, if I'd known how rare it was at the time, I would have probably gone into it with a lot more trepidation. But because I didn't really know how rare it was, I was just able to say, look, I've written a book, blah, blah, blah. Let's go and get it published. So having a South Asian editor was incredible and really fun. She was really able to sell it to her colleagues within publishing, which is one of the things that you don't really know about. Publishing is editors being able to sell their books to their colleagues, to their publishing teams, publicity teams, marketing teams, which is something that you don't really know about. It's this kind of internal pressure to get their books out on top. So yeah, I was so fortunate to have a South Asian editor, a South Asian woman editor as well.
And do you think it would have been different had your editor not been South Asian? Do you think there is that element of being able to understand and to really convey, or, you know, be familiar with the content that means that process of having to go and sell and kind of get people to buy into the book is slightly easier?
Well, I mean, potentially. I mean, I've mentioned that my American editor is a white lady called Emily, and she's wonderful. You know, she's never asked me to explain on the page. She's never asked me to do anything like that. Potentially in pitching meetings, you know, there is a difference in terms of that sort of, I don't know, that sort of cultural, being able to explain cultures better. But I don't really think so. I think I've been really lucky with the people that I found in publishing. I think that's what all the South Asian authors I've talked to have said so far, that if you find a team of people who are able to be behind you, that's what's important. But it's getting to the point that you can find that team, which is where so many South Asian authors never get to, because their books are shot down in the acquisition meetings, which form the heart of who gets published and who doesn't. Because one white editorial director or publishing director can say, no, that's never going to sell. I don't see that on the page. I don't understand why that's relevant or important. So it's important to have people who are pushing for you, but they don't necessarily have to be South Asian.
Mm. And South Asian or not, which writers inspired you, do you think, and have had an influence on your writing?
I'd say fewer of the authors who are held up as part of the South Asian kind of canon, because they were the ones who were kind of in some ways foisted on you. Because I remember being a kid, 14, 15 years old, walking into my school library and them saying, oh, you have to read Arundhati Roy, you have to read Salman Rushdie. And I was like, well, I can read other people as well. And I enjoy South Asian authors who are published in South Asia who haven't made their way to Britain so far. Those are the people I really enjoy because they speak to me in a way that very few other people can. So Paramal Murugan, who's very good. Avni Doshi, who was somebody who was in India, but now is kind of in this country as well, which is a really, really interesting part of publishing. Really interesting about how, you know, how many more Indian journalists talk about you when you have a British publishing contract rather than when you had an Indian publishing contract. Now that's a whole spicy kettle of fish. People like that, kind of S. Harish, Vivek Shanbhag, loads of people like that who are Indian authors who are popular in India, but not in the rest of the world yet.
And when you were at school in Britain, mm-hmm. who were you reading anyone, you know, on the national curriculum that has had any impact upon you now?
In a rather problematic sense, I think, because if you're from an Indian middle class family, you're always surrounded by books and you're surrounded by these yellowing paperbacks from like the 1960s and 70s, like these orange penguin ones, as well as a lot of trash. So my teenage kind of reading tastes were always P.G. Woodhouse, Enid Blyton, kind of Evelyn Waugh, that kind of sense, as well as the really trashy 1980s and 1990s kind of Clive Cussler, kind of Jason Bourne, that sort of, like, because if you're from an Indian household, that's what your books look like. You've got Somerset Maugham there, and then you've got Robert Ludlum there about, like, anti-Semitic conspiracies. And one thing is also about anti-Semitic conspiracies, but, like, in an English castle. So that's how those two things come together. So that's why I don't really care about literary fiction as a term. I just want to do whatever I want to do on the page, because those are the sort of books I grew up reading. Nobody was like, oh, wow, this is Anita Bruckner. You know, she's really proper and prim, and, you know, this is so wonderful. It's just like, just do what you want on the page, just read whatever. So yeah.
Great. And so what's next for you? I know you've mentioned the book that you're writing. Would you be able to provide a little bit more flavor as to what we might expect?
Yeah, so it's a cozy crime, but set in Oxbridge, which I have a little bit of, I have enough experience with now at this point, and it's just about POCs and crime solving and mysteries and thrillers and romance and just, again, blowing everything up. I think I'm a bit I mean, I'm a bit too violent as a novelist, because on the page, I always want to do something that breaks everything. Because when I was writing How to Kidnap the Rich, I was trying to write like a 600-page novel in 200 pages. So everything is accelerated, everything is broken, all the obstacles in the way are just overmounted and surmounted by the characters. Those are the people I'm interested in, people who break systems. So having POC characters in Oxbridge, solving crimes, that for me is just like, I'm having so much fun. It's like, let's explode everything.
And is there anything you've learned from writing How to Kidnap the Rich that is standing you in really good stead for the next book, do you think?
do what you want, but don't swear too much. Because you'll get a lot of very angry people sending you kind of messages about, yes, how you've ruined their book club in Cheshire.
They can get over it, I think.
Maybe, yeah.
Great. Well, no, thank you so much. It's been such an interesting talk, and I'm glad that my favourite conversations are always the ones that break off and are more of a discussion. So thank you. It's been really interesting.
Thank you. And I mean, I could have asked you guys like 15 more questions. It could have been like your podcast. I'm glad I didn't. Maybe I should do a podcast like that, which is just me asking other people hundreds of questions and just sitting there going, Okay, but anyway, thank you so much.
We'd be up for that. We'll come on anytime.
Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you've heard, please rate, subscribe, and spread the word.
Give us a follow on Instagram at browniepodcast or email us at browniepodcast@gmail.com.
See you next time.